This is Story Behind the Story. I'm Clara Shirley Appel. My guest today, Marcus Gazaway, got his start as a writer right here on the Central Coast when he joined the staff of CSU Monterey-based student newspaper, The Otter Realm. Today, he works as a full-time author in Sarasota, Florida, where he can be seen reading and writing in coffee shops across the Gulf Coast. His first novel, the sci-fi thriller Bridgewater, follows a neurologist whose desperation to give his deaf daughter a voice leads him down a dark and destructive path. It is the topic of our conversation today. Marcus Gazaway, welcome to Story Behind the Story.
Hi, thank you so much for having me. Happy to be here.
We always love having local writers on or people with a local connection, so I was really excited to do this interview. And I'd like to start by asking you about the, I think, pretty unique premise of Bridgewater. What inspired you to write a thriller about neurology?
I have a twin brother, and everyone's always joked about twins having telepathy and stuff like that. And I've always just had a story in the back of my mind about how telepathy would come about. What I originally wanted to write it was a story about like me and my best friend having a telepathic connection. But then I started to ask, like, where did that come from? How would we have telepathy? So then it got me to go back into thinking just it created like a character who would actually have a reason for needing to develop telepathy, which is the daughter who's born deaf, mute, who's always wanted a voice. And so he's a highly intelligent neurologist that's capable of doing something like that. And so once I just started like answering the questions of like how and why and who, then I was like, okay, before I write this second book of two boys with telepathy or two friends with telepathy, I need to write the book where that telepathy came from. Because I'll read some books or watch some movies or shows, and then like suddenly some person has a superpower or they have some ability that they've always had. And like, I kind of hate when stories do that. So I wanted to create this first book and tell like where all this stuff came from and why it even exists in the first place.
Yeah, provide some rationale, some explanation.
Yeah, yep.
I can imagine as you're doing that and you're deciding that, oh, it comes from neurological research, that's not a topic that your background leads me to believe you had a lot of familiarity with. So what was the research process like for you, and what challenges did you face in trying to incorporate a pretty complicated scientific subject into such a plot-forward work of fiction?
Yeah, I Googled a lot of neurological studies and actually tried to keep it as realistic as I could for telepathy existing. And I actually researched different brain cells and what they're capable of. And I referenced the Purkinje cell in the book. And that cell is actually the only brain cell that puts an outward signal. All the other brain cells just communicate within the brain. But so that's where I like got the Purkinje cell and put it into the book. Yeah, it was a good bit of research. And then I'm not sure if a neurologist has read the book yet, but I would be interested to get their take on that and to see how well of a job they think I did. Because I go in, I think it's chapter 3. Where I go into kind of the scientific explanation of how he developed telepathy.
How important do you think that level of scientific realism is in a book like this? I mean, in fiction in general, but I think for something that is a thriller, something that is sort of based in science to some extent.
I think it can be important depending on like the reader or even the author. Like to me, it was important. And also for like stuff that I see, like I really want to know kind of like the origin of things and also like how things work. Because it's like you can come up with any type of crazy ability or any type of introduce some crazy like element into the story. But even if it's just one sentence or a paragraph that explains how it works, then like I'm more into the story. I'm more invested in the story because then it's just like, oh, yeah, I could see how that would exist. Oh, and so I wanted to make the story seem like as believable as possible. Like back in the year 2000, like this happened and this is how it happened.
So let's talk about that sort of temporal setting, because the novel includes a lot of futuristic elements from robots to substantial developments in medical technology. but it takes place over 20 years in the past. Yeah. How did you decide when to place Bridgewater in time? And what aspects of that setting were appealing to you? And what difficulties did you face in writing a sci-fi novel set in the past?
Yeah, I grew up in the 2000s. So mm-hmm. that's like kind of my favorite like decade, my favorite era, which was just like music, technology, because I think around like 2007, that's when like social media started blowing up and like the first smartphone came out. And that's when like Facebook first arrived on the scene. So I kind of wanted to like predate that and start it like in the year 2000. But as far as like struggling with, like the internet and social media and like getting the word out there about crazy stuff happening, which happens in this book, is like less of a thing. And that's like pre 9/11, you know? So it's like we're a lot more, you know, at ease. People aren't as high alert. People aren't recording everything with their phone. So this thing seems, the story anyway, seems a little more possible with without having the smartphones, the social medias, and all that stuff. But honestly, to answer your question, I love the early 2000s. So like I want to, as I continue on with this series, I'm going to incorporate like a lot more of the early 2000s just stuff, I guess, like what's the word, like the zeitgeist, or the way people talked, or the things that were like in like MySpace, Facebook, Blockbuster, stuff like that. It's all part of like my teenage years and growing up. So I wanted to write that in a story that I wanted to tell.
One thing that I noticed is that I think it works really well once you get to the sort of more fast-paced part, once you have one of your characters, once you have Bridgewater making his escape and trying to like find a place where people won't recognize him. That's so much easier when you're working in the world of like physical print newspapers than it is when you're working with the internet. Was that something that you considered up front, or was it just kind of like a lucky, something you lucked into?
I guess something I lucked into, but I grew up in the South. So like I wanted it to, the story to go to that setting, because it's, you know, it's like or a lot of writers say, write what you know. And it's like, what I know really well is growing up in the South, how things are in the South. And then also the early 2000s, which I grew up in, which I love. But yeah, as far like, because also just like a small town in the middle of nowhere, like in the South, like they're not going to have much of like a media reliance, or they're not going to be jumping on the headline news or anything like that. But yeah, I guess I did look into it, but I was going to put the story there anyway.
I mentioned this in introducing you, but you got your writing start as a student journalist. I'm curious how your experiences writing nonfiction, writing in that journalistic style, have informed your approach as a novelist.
I would say it's like helped zero. To be honest with you, like I've always written creatively just for fun, but I've never taken on something as big as this before. But honestly, what really got me to write this book is I had an injury happen, and I wasn't able to walk for like a year, because it was a pretty severe injury. I can't really go into like too much detail because it's still like an ongoing lawsuit with the injury. But it was so like I wasn't sure, like, all right, what am I going to do with my life? What am I going to do with my time? Because I was working as like an AV engineer. So that's like there's physical aspects of that job, and you definitely have to be on your feet, walking, standing, carrying, lifting, all that stuff. And I wasn't able to do that for a year. So I was like, I need to do, I'm a pretty proactive person, you know? So I was like, okay, I'm going to start writing, because I love to write. And it's like, if I like it, then I'm just going to keep doing it. And it turns out I loved it. Like, I was like, oh man, this is what I really want to do. And so that's like, and then I think for 1 year, it took me like a whole year to write like my first draft.
That's honestly pretty fast for a first time writer, I think.
Yeah, I would think so. Yeah, because like now it's like, okay, I could probably write a first draft in 4 or 6 months, because like I worked on it. I wrote, man, probably 50 drafts from after the first year. So for like the next 2 years, I wrote, probably like 50 drafts until I wrote it up until like the day of publication in October of 2023. And I started writing it in March of 2021. That's when I first like put something down. But I forget what your question is.
Okay.
I remember now. Yeah. If my Outer Realm journalistic nonfiction experience helped with this, I would say because you have to write hundreds of papers in college, you know?
Yeah.
So I've had some really tough professors that are like, you're using the word the too much, you're using the word very too much.
Mm-hmm.
And they mark off for stuff like that. So it's like, I definitely carried that into writing. Like, cause I think something I do too much is I use the same word over and over and over. From like my education background, and keeping my grammar straight, it was, I'd say the nonfiction writing played a part in that. Yeah.
I'd like to hear a little bit more. You talked sort of briefly about how long it took you to create this, to create your first draft and how many drafts you sort of went through. I'd like to get a little bit more detail on what that process looked like. So how much did you have mapped out ahead of time, and what kind of surprises did you encounter through the writing process?
Yeah. How much did I have mapped out? I had the whole thing mapped out, like outlined before I wrote it. Like,
okay.
I knew where I wanted to start, and then I knew where I wanted it to end. And then from there, I filled in a lot of like where I wanted it to go. But I think like along the way, I changed a lot. Because I changed a lot of what I wrote. Because I probably have over 100,000 words of stuff I didn't use. Like I saved it, but I deleted it. And there was chapters that I rewrote entirely, like numerous times. So even if I have things like mapped out, once I like step away from it, and something that really helps is like if you write for 3 months straight. And then like the best thing that I did for myself was just I left it alone for like a month. And then I went back to it and I was like, oh, this is terrible. This is terrible. This is awesome. This is good. And then that really helped me like dissect what I was going to use and then what I needed to redo. And I remember like, I think a couple months before publication, there was two chapters that I just couldn't accept. Like I was just like, I can do better than what those are. And I rewrote two chapters like 2 months before publication, but it made it work. So I guess as far as like restructuring, it's like never ending until like, because I set that publication date at the beginning of 2023, and I was like, that's when I'm gonna be done because I've worked on it for like a long time at this point. But yeah, it's probably one of the hardest things I've ever done, but it's a ton of work, ton of discipline, and just sitting and writing and being honest with yourself. Cause like you know, deep down when something's like not good, or you know, you can do something better that's more intriguing for the reader, or you can make a sentence better or a certain moment better. So.
There's nothing like a Grateful Dead concert, and there's nothing like the Grateful Dead Zone. Host Eric Nelson assembles the Ultimate Dead Concert, a make-believe psychedelic ballroom with two sets of Dead music, each song taken from a different concert and a different year, selected from the very best of their vast live archive. Whether you're a Deadhead or a casual bystander, let there be songs to fill the airwaves on the Grateful Dead Zone every Saturday at noon, only on K-Squid 89.5, 89.7, and 90.7 FM and KSQD.org. If you're just joining me, my guest today is writer and CSUMB graduate Marcus Ryan Gazaway, whose sci-fi thriller, Bridgewater, tells the story of a brilliant neurologist who will stop at nothing to give his daughter the life she deserves. What are some of the biggest changes between some of those early drafts and where the book ended up? Are they purely craft changes, right, at the sentence level, at the paragraph level, or did you have major changes in sort of plot and story?
Yeah, I had both major changes in plot and story. Also, I got feedback from beta readers and a lot of my family. So sometimes they would say things that I'm like, you're right. Like that part is like not good enough. Or and they wouldn't say it's not good enough, but they're like, I wanted more of like this, or I wasn't sure about this thing that happened, or like what if this and this happened? So sometimes people would hit on something that was like really profound, and like I guess it would end up changing the plot a little bit, or I would like have to craft certain things differently. But one thing that was big is like my sister. Let's see. I don't want to give anything away. Let me see. My sister said, like, she said that I don't think I can say it without giving anything away. So, but she wanted Dr. Bridgewater to be a little more like remorseful about something that happened, and because she said it seemed like this thing happened that was very tragic, and he kind of just moved on, and like. That changed a lot of like crafting the story and kind of the direction of the story when she said that. Cause I was like, she's right. Like I do kind of just like keep the story going without, cause this big thing happened and I just didn't reference it enough, or I didn't like give it enough justice, I guess. And this is probably like the second draft.
Yeah.
But by the end, like it's, that thing I'm talking about is in like every chapter. Yeah, if you've read it, then you kind of
I've read the whole thing. Yeah.
Okay. Then yeah, you probably know what I'm talking about.
Yeah, I have a sense.
Okay. So yeah, that was definitely beta readers and family giving me feedback that helped change the plot, but the ending changed a lot. Yeah, because I was trying like nailing that landing and that ending. Is really hard because you want to leave the reader wanting more, and then also you want to tie everything up that you started at the beginning. That's what I tried to do. Was like at the end, leave the reader like wanting to know what's gonna happen next, but everything else that happened, you kind of like you seal it off. So yeah.
One thing I'm curious about, so this is a self-published novel, if I'm reading things correctly.
Yes.
Was that always your plan? Did you always go into it knowing like, hey, this is the model I want to take for publication? Mm-hmm. And what was behind that choice for you?
Yeah, it was, I looked at traditional publishing and I submitted some drafts to traditional publishers, but to be honest, it really wasn't ready. So I'm not a well-known person. I'm not a well-known author. I don't have a huge social media presence. So I'm not like the most attractive writer to an agent or a publishing company at the moment. So I kind of knew like self-publishing was where I was going to go. And honestly, I'm pretty happy with how it's turned out so far. So I'm only 4 months in.
Mm-hmm.
But it's been great learning experience, and I just feel like a more capable writer and then publisher as well. So I think like further down the road, if I meet someone who was like me 3 years ago, like if 10 years from now I meet someone who's just really starting out, but they have a great concept for their book, or they have a great draft of their book, and you can see something's there, then maybe I would use my publishing company name, which is Leopolis Publications, to publish authors who were just like me back in the day. But we'll see how successful I can take my writing, my book series. But yeah.
I think there have been some really interesting stories lately about like success stories from self-publishing. So I think the guy who wrote the Silo novels, all of those were self-published. And you look at something like that, and you start to see somebody who's had the level of success that he's had, where he has, you know, a TV deal on Apple.
Okay.
And you think about that in terms of the self-publishing model versus the traditional publishing model. If you can be successful in self-publishing, it can be really, really lucrative and also give you a lot more creative freedom than you might have in that traditional way. in that sort of traditional publishing model. So it's kind of interesting to see how, like, I feel like that's something that shifted even in the last like 5 to 10 years, and maybe the pandemic had something to do with it.
Yeah, I definitely think the pandemic had something to do with it. And then I think the creative freedom is like the number one driving force for a lot of self-publishers. And like, I was going to do what I wanted to do anyway. Like, if anyone wanted to take creative control, but they wanted the rights to my book, like, it's no deal, you know?
Yeah.
So like, I want to be able to write. That's the most fun part about writing. It's like, oh, I can do anything. Like, I can have an elephant come down in a hot air balloon if I want. If I can make it make sense, I can write it, then yeah. And I want that kind of freedom when I write. So I'd probably keep going the self-publishing route unless someone made a unbelievable offer. But yeah.
Have you had much opportunity to engage with readers of the book since it came out?
Yeah. Oh yeah. Yeah, I've had beta readers, and then I've had tons of people that I haven't heard from in like probably like over a decade. People from elementary or from teachers from way back in the day, and then also just like strangers who have left reviews on my book. And yeah, I think like 50 something beta readers, because I turned my book into Book Sirens, and then people could download it,
right,
and just start reading it. And I got a lot of feedback from them, and I mean, the overall response is really really positive. There was there's one thing you said that, oh yeah, the book takes a minute to get going. I think with my second book, I'm gonna hit the ground running. But it's like, I tell a lot of people, if you read to like chapter 7, like then that's when the book really takes off. Like, that's when you really know the ride you're in for, like with reading this book. Cause it kind of just seems like a regular story, you know, of a father and a daughter. They have some, they have like some challenges or some speed bumps they're going through until you hit that. And that's when you really kind of know who Dr. Bridgewater is and what he's really up to, I guess. So
I want to ask you one more question before we have you read from the book itself. This is your first novel, but your entire life has been dominated by creative pursuits in one sense or another. You had a storied career as a musician and a recording artist. How does the medium that you're working in affect your understanding of the creative message that you're trying to convey? And do you find that you can access parts of your creativity more readily in one medium or the other?
Yeah, I think they kind of like, they have a lot in common, like I'd say music and writing. And because in like writing music, those are definitely like, they both like kind of come from like emotion and feeling, you know, when you're writing music and you're listening to music, it evokes like an emotion deep within you. And then like also when you're writing, you're kind of just writing from this emotional like center. So yeah, I definitely tapped into kind of like, I play drums, and drums are very dynamic. So sometimes they're just really soft and you're just hitting really lightly, and then sometimes they're just really loud and they're wild and chaotic. So I use that flow, I think, in my writing, and tapped into it. It's probably something that's always like been a part of me, and I can kind of use it for any creative avenue that I go down.
Join KSQD the second Sunday each month for Intersections, hosted by Seth Shapiro. Intersections takes you to the crossroads of ideas, mapping the contours of belief and knowledge through the stories and lives of influential voices. Meet notable people in diverse fields who are asking important questions. Their experiences and perspectives challenge us to pursue lives of meaning and purpose. Tune into Intersections Sunday evening at 6 here on KSQD 89.5, 89.7, and 90.7 FM and KSQD.org. Many voices, one station. If you're just joining me, my guest today is writer and CSUMB graduate Marcus Ryan Gazaway, whose sci-fi thriller, Bridgewater, tells the story of a brilliant neurologist who will stop at nothing to give his daughter the life she deserves. Well, like I said, I want to have you read a little bit from the book now so we can introduce the audience to what your actual writing is like and who these characters are. Before you start, can you tell us a little bit about what you're going to read?
Yeah, this is a big part. This is pretty deep into the book. It's chapter 30. So, I mean, it gives a little bit away, but what it gives away is like, yeah, you're still going to want to like read to find out how it even got to this point. But yeah, in this scene, to just lay it out, there is Dr. Bridgewater, who is trying to keep his identity hidden, and he's in this place called Cake Town. And his boss, who he's been working for, has just discovered who he really is. He's been going under an alias of Dr. Clark. But he has just found out that Dr. Clark is actually Dr. Bridgewater. And he decides to, he actually has him at gunpoint in his office in the scene. And so this is the conversation that happens between the two of them. Once he has him at gunpoint, and he's basically, you know, waiting for the police to show up.
Great.
Clouds of white smoke now whirled about the air, making the room appear like the inside of a shaken snow globe. Dr. Weed squinted, blew out a long, slow stream of pipe smoke from the corner of his mouth before he spoke. So all those bodies you buried, did you know them before you kept their identities, or did it even matter whose life you were taking? The white-haired doctor took two more long pulls from the end of his pipe while he watched the face of Dr. Bridgewater closely, awaiting a response. The tobacco in his pipe turned to glowing, fiery embers and lit up the edges of his face as more smoke drifted past his partially open lips. Nothing to say to that? Dr. Wheat lowered his ember-filled pipe and looked at Ivan with squinted eyes as if it were a blurry image he couldn't quite make out. I shouldn't be surprised. Look at you. You're too stunned to speak. I bet you never thought you'd get caught or that those bodies would ever see the light of day. And now the whole country is going to know their names, the names of every life you took. You can't even comprehend what's about to happen to you, can you? Dr. Wheat shook his head and adjusted the rifle, leaning it over his shoulder. Or maybe you're just not ready to accept the truth. Dr. Wheat raised his chin, wondering what was going through Dr. Bridgewater's head. But I'll be honest with you, Ivan. You sure made a fool out of me. From the moment I met you, I liked you. I even thought we were going to be friends. I imagine we would do a lot of good together. There was certainly nothing about you that told me you could harm anyone or kill anyone. I assumed the opposite, and I believed every word you told me about wanting to help K-Town. Dr. Wheat laughed softly to himself and tapped away some of the ash from his pipe with his index finger. But that's the part that confuses me the most. Why here? Why Cake Town? Because if you're as smart as you seem, then you'd have known to stay as far away from this place as you could. Evil doesn't survive here. It floats to the surface and gets washed away like a log in a stream. This town has seen everything from war, corruption, and economic collapse, and has never faltered. Hope is ingrained in our history and into every citizen that calls this place home. And I don't think a single body could go missing here without everyone gathering up and searching every inch of this place until they're found. Believe me when I tell you, the darkness you bring is the only thing that would get buried here, Dr. Bridgewater. Dr. Wheat stepped in front of the window opposite Ivan and pulled back the curtain. He looked past the patients and out to the parking lot where vehicles filled nearly every parking spot. There's no need to keep watching for the police. Dr. Wheat glanced at Ivan. You'll hear the cavalry coming before you see them. The two doctors stood in front of rectangular windows that stood 10 feet apart from one another, observing all the activity taking place in front of the care center. Watching other people go about their days seemed to make them pause and escape their tense situation for a moment, while pipe smoke floated across their faces like drifting clouds. Like most people, Dr. Wheat, Ivan finally spoke. You fail to understand that our perceptions are far more than what we can hear, feel, or read in some newspaper. As we both know, intelligence begins with the ability to look beyond what's presented to us. So from what small amount of information you've been given, you believe I am a ruthless killer, murdering wherever I go for my own pleasure. But did it ever occur to you that there is far more to my story than you or any quickly written article could possibly understand? Dr. Wheat couldn't help but smile. Has he been waiting to hear from the infamous Dr. Bridgewater? He tapped his pipe against the fireplace, sending ashes gently down to the stone base below before he spoke. My perception is not what matters here, Dr. Wheat. Dr. Weed shook his head. It is by the perception of the law and the evidence that's been discovered that confirms you are a killer. Ivan raised his chin and lowered his eyebrows, taking in a long, pensive breath as the swirling smoke in the air entered his nostrils and seared his lungs. Believe it or not, Sydney, said Dr. Bridgewater with a clear of his throat, moving the curtain to the side with his hand, your perception does matter. More specifically, your perception of the law. You need your perception because without it, you're as much of a killer as I am. Did you not take those men's lives and more? Did you not watch them die? Believe it or not, Dr. Weed's hardened expression returned to his face at the mention of his time in the military. Killing in the war is far different than killing civilians seeking medical treatment. We do not kill for the same reasons. In war, we agree to kill, and we agree to die every time we step on that battlefield. We fought for freedom and killed those who dared to take it away. Of course, Sydney, nodded Ivan, putting his hands behind his back while the curtain swayed in front of him. And that's why you and your brothers in arms are considered this country's greatest generation. You did what you had to do. But as more and more people were killed, eventually the war ended, and that end transformed the world forever. It transformed it for the better, did it not? You killed for reasons greater than yourself, same as I've done. You killed innocent people, Doctor. Dr. Wheat raised his voice and stiffened his posture. I fought to protect innocent lives and my country. You're a serial killer, preying on innocent lives. Again, Sydney, Ivan tilted his head sideways while his eyes darted left to right, scanning the parking lot. You are not looking beyond the information that was presented to you. However, unlike you, I won't deny that I am a killer. I've watched hundreds of souls leave their bodies, and there is no doubt blood on my hands. But much like you, I've killed for those I've loved. So we are the same no matter how you want to perceive it. We are killers. Dr. Weed's face tightened with restrained anger, regretting spurring Dr. Bridgewater into conversation. I think you've said enough. Dr. Weed set his pipe down on the mantel and gripped his rifle with two hands. While we are both killers, we are similar and different in many instances, Sydney. Ivan ignored Dr. Wheat's order to stop talking. Regardless of the lives we've taken, we remain identical in the fact that we are both insignificant men standing alone in a room together. And outside this window are crowds of other insignificant people, and beyond them is an entire planet filled with billions of insignificant people. Those people are not insignificant, Dr. Wheat began to yell. They're why I'm still a practicing doctor well into my 70s. When I should be retired. They're why you and I are even able to call ourselves doctors, something you seem to have forgotten. That is where we differ, Dr. Bridgewater. So you can save your... No, Sydney, interjected Ivan. Where we differ is in the fact that I can make myself significant. I can make each and every insignificant person in this world significant. Yes, you can treat them with medicine, but I can empower them. I can make them better than what they ever thought they could be. What are you talking about? Burst Dr. Wheat with a look of disgust that lengthened the wrinkles on his face. Make them significant. You just said yourself you've killed them, and even if you could empower them, how can you even begin to justify all the lives you took? Dr. Bridgewater looked down at his shoes with a frown and took a small step forward, now standing inches from the swaying curtain. Justify? Ivan looked up and back out the window. Why do you or I owe anyone an explanation for what we've done or the lives we took? Was the use of atomic nuclei to create nuclear fission to kill more people at a faster rate than ever thought possible justified? Was it justified when two atomic bombs were dropped on the heads of innocent people? Did their death not end the fighting? Did the loss of their lives and the end of that war not provide this country with all the success and opportunity we see today? Your perception is that you were killing to defeat evil, but without that perception, those people were murdered to make the world a better place, were they not, Dr. Weed? If murdering for the greater good of humanity can be justified, then am I not justified? Dr. Bridgewater paused. He shook his head with a heavy sigh. He knew Dr. Weed was aware of how much death the war had brought to the world and would not want to discuss it with him. I believe you already know the answer, Sydney, said Ivan. You're just too afraid to say it. Too afraid to recognize the truth of what death creates, that war reshaped the lives of every person on this planet. Economies, technology, militaries, and entire countries were changed forever when thousands upon thousands of innocent people died. So yes, your generation did what they had to do, but don't pretend ruthless killing didn't lead to progress, to change, to innovation. You're no more righteous than I am, and you're not some ignorant soldier. So don't tell me each person you murdered was significant when you know damn well they were never of any significance to you. Enough, roared Dr. Wheat, lifting his gun and pointing at the side of Dr. Bridgewater's head from across the room. Not another word. Ivan didn't speak, but he turned his body and faced the elderly doctor for the first time since he had been captured. Dr. Wheat looked startled. He almost lowered his weapon as the barrel was now pointed directly at Ivan's chest. He stepped back. He did not want to prove the neurologist right, pulling the trigger and becoming the very thing he denied to be. Where we are similar, Sydney, Ivan lowered his head and looked over the frame of his glasses, locking eyes with Dr. Wheat, is that we've both killed enough men to recognize the look a man gets in his eye when he's about to die. Screams erupted from the front porch. The people outside had disappeared from the windows in front of the doctors. Footsteps thundered against the wood porch, scurrying in all directions. The sound of an engine revving and screeching tires could be heard in the distance. It no longer matters what you think, Dr. Bridgewater. Dr. Wheat let out a relieved sigh and walked up to the window to see what the commotion was about. Sounds like the cavalry has arrived. Dr. Bridgewater walked backward toward the corner of the office, watching as Dr. Wheat pulled the curtain back with his hand. He saw the old man's light brown eyes grow large. His face went pale with horror as every inch of sunlight that shone through the window shrank into darkness until the entire office went black as night. Unfortunately, said Dr. Bridgewater, I am the cavalry. The window exploded inward and Dr. Wheat was devoured beneath a wave of debris. The floor trembled. Ivan crumpled his tall frame down at the corner of the room, covering his face as he watched the outer wall of the care center pour inside as if a dam had burst. Shattered wood and broken glass shot through the air like shrapnel and flooded the office. Sparks flashed like fireworks in every direction as electric wires that once lined the interior of the walls snapped with static bursts of flames. A blood-churning scream rattled over the sound of the crumbling wall. The chaotic sounds filled Ivan's ears until everything faded to silence all at once and nothing moved. The only thing he could hear was his own frantic and heavy breath that seemed to tell him he was alive. And that's the section.
Thank you so much.
Yeah, no problem.
Join KSQD every Monday evening for the award-winning program Peace Talks Radio. News of war, conflict, and political divisiveness fill our media. The Peace Talks Radio series helps counterbalance that with talk about making peace in our daily lives and information on topics that relate to a more peaceful world, locally, nationally, and globally. Peace Talks Radio airs Monday at 6 p.m. here at KSQD 89.5, 89.7, and 90.7 FM and KSQD.org. Many voices, one station. If you're just joining me, my guest today is writer and CSUMB graduate Marcus Ryan Gazaway, whose sci-fi thriller, Bridgewater, tells the story of a brilliant neurologist who will stop at nothing to give his daughter the life she deserves. I wanted to start this second half of our interview by talking about how you understand Dr. Bridgewater, because this is a conversation between him and another doctor that is largely about their perceptions and understandings of morality and where they see their own roles in society and within that sort of moral structure. So how do you see Dr. Bridgewater? Is he evil, like Dr. Clark says, or is he something else?
That's, I guess that's up to the reader. But if you're asking me if he's evil, yes, he is evil. Yes, this book essentially is the origin of a villain who doesn't quite realize he's really a villain yet, but he kind of recognizes that towards the end. But what he's doing is definitely evil, but what he believes he's doing it for is for the greater good, but also for love. He's doing it for someone he loves. And so whatever he has to do, he's willing to do it. As long as he's doing it for the person that he loves or to help someone he loves. So in that sense, that's not exactly evil. That's why I put the quote at the beginning of the book, whatever is done for love goes beyond good and evil. So I think that sums up who Dr. Bridgewater is. And he is that quote, because he's willing to go, as you can see in the book, to any length to accomplish what he wants for someone he loves. He's not really doing it for himself, not necessarily.
You know, it's interesting that you say that, because I think throughout the book, Dr. Bridgewater asserts that he pursues this ruthless program of research in part to give his daughter what he believes she wants more than anything, this sort of platonic, ordinary life. But as I was reading, I found myself interrogating not just that desire, his desire to give her that, but whether he even really understood what she wanted. And I'm curious what you think on that. Does Ivan understand what his daughter wants? Is he acting in accordance with her wishes? Or is he projecting in order to meet some broader goals that he has?
He's projecting what he feels that would give her what she needs. And he also feels like he's the one who has to give it to her. Because he's like raised her by himself, essentially, since she was born. He's given her the ability to sign, given her the ability to pursue all the hobbies and passions that she's into. And then to give her a voice, he wants to be the one to give her that voice. And also, it's something I don't know if I detailed. I'm pretty sure I detailed it to some extent, but he feels like he's losing his daughter as she's getting older, because she's 12 and she's becoming like a teenage girl, rebelling and somewhat rebelling, and then, you know, wanting to hang out with other girls her age or boys, and not necessarily her father. And that's new to him, who's, you know, had her by his side, like, you know, for the past 12 years. So this is something that will actually connect them together and bring them closer. So that's, I guess it's a little selfish on his part there. So that is him doing it for himself, but it will also give her something that he knows she would want, or he knows that she could use. Mm-hmm. Because it's also something that he knows other, he says it a lot, it's like, this can change the lives of every like deaf person or person who's lost the ability to speak. You know, if someone loses that part of their brain to be able to speak and they can't even use like their hands to sign or anything, then it's like he has something that could allow them to communicate with someone, to allow them to get their thoughts out there. So, and he knows that. That's also, he's also works in the medical field. So that's also something that, you know, would help people. So he's aware.
I'm curious. I'm not sure what your familiarity is with sort of conversations in the deaf community. I did some research on sign languages and with the deaf community in my graduate program over a decade ago at this point. And a lot, there are some really interesting conversations. Some assistive technology is very controversial, right? Like cochlear implants, which are used to give people who are congenitally deaf an ability to hear and process sound. Mm-hmm. There's a lot of controversy within the deaf community about whether, about what, how they should be used, when they should be used, whether, you know, what the sort of, what the positioning that somebody who has a cochlear implant has with respect to the community. And I imagine there's some, there would be similar conversations about any kind of medical intervention like telepathy. I'm curious how aware of those conversations you are and how you see your book engaging with them.
Yeah, I haven't gotten, I'm not aware of anyone who actually is deaf that's read the book. Yeah, I've heard that thing about some of them just wanted, like, they don't want to have the implant, like they're, like almost like, you know, proud to be deaf, and they're they're okay with how they have to live their life, like just being deaf, and they don't want the assistance. And sometimes it doesn't even work, like for some people, like it doesn't help them at all. But there's a character in there. I think if you remember Brandon,
is he the second child?
Yes.
Okay. Yeah. I won't say more than that, but yeah.
So I'm able to dive deeper into that with that character in the second book. But yeah, I've done the research, but you know, there's not much on telepathy and how the community feels about it. But I'm using a bit of my imagination, but I'm also aware that, like, you know, there are certain feelings about you know, having a substitute form of hearing and communication. Yeah.
And I think it is really interesting, too, that much like how things often work with cochlear implants, it is often a hearing parent or adult who is providing that technology, who is making the decisions about that technology for a kid. I'll be really interested to see how that plays out in book two.
Yeah, it's I'm writing it right now. So it's this is probably gonna be my favorite book. But yeah. This is kind of the book I wanted to originally write.
Yeah. Yeah, that's kind of what you said with the sort of analogy to your twin brother.
So I've had this thought, this book in my head for a long time now. And then I was just like, well, before I write this, I need to establish where all this comes from. So, and then the first book kind of started creating itself as I answered those questions.
So I want to ask you too, right? Part of what Bridgewater is about is what we both individually and as a society are willing to give up for the sake of progress. There's several references to Machiavelli early in the novel, both in terms of Bridgewater's own understanding of his sort of Machiavellian impulses, but also this projection of a Machiavellian impulse onto his daughter. And I'm curious what makes this question so compelling for you and what you were hoping to understand, you know, as a person and as a writer through exploring this story.
Yeah, I guess the question of what people are willing to sacrifice for, you know, the nice things we have in life, or for, you know, innovation. I kind of did it just to make people like think about that question and think about, like, you know, that is where a lot of the really nice things we have, or the advancements in technology, they kind of come from a place like that. And that's what made me choose the subtitle, is What Death Creates. Because it's like, death does create like change. Death does bring about like world-changing innovations. So that's a theme that I wanted to have in the book. And it's, I guess I don't really have like an answer, like a right answer for, you know, what we should do about this, or the right way of how the world should be. But it's definitely because I think about it. So it's like, I guess just to make the reader, you know, think about, yeah, it's like that's kind of true in a lot of ways. So I wanted to, this is a villain character I have in here. So I wanted to, he's aware of that too. He's very aware of what death creates. So that's definitely.
Well, and I think that portion, that excerpt that you read, shows one of his sort of unique attributes is his willingness to face that, right? Mm-hmm. What he does with that.
Yeah.
You know, pretty horrific, but it is, right, he is willing to look that in the eye, to very head on say, this is what I'm doing, and I understand the cost of what I'm doing.
Yeah. Look at the really base form of what all this is, you know, what really goes on in the world. And he's okay with it, you know, because he's just like, if all these entities, these like governments, militaries, these people who are just like him can make these types of decisions, then why can't he? Because like, he's intelligent and powerful enough to create something that's world changing, you know? So, and if it's at the cost of lives, then he's like, then what's the difference if I do it, as opposed to a military with 100 soldiers doing it, you know? Yeah, that's his rationale. Yeah.
Changing text a little bit, what were your favorite parts of Bridgewater to write?
My favorite parts to write, let's see. Oh my gosh. Definitely him and Julia, him and Dr. Fox, and then Cake Town. I love Cake Town. Is the combination of all my favorite places in the South that I grew up living in.
Mm.
My parents had a place with like big lakes, like just a little piece of land that we would go and visit on weekends and stuff. And then I went to a camp up in the mountains. So we had like the Georgia mountains up there. And then I lived near a square with a statue in the middle of it. So like that, those are all features of Cape Town. But definitely Dr. Bridgewater's interactions with somewhat more innocent and naive people is my favorite thing to write in that story. Yeah, that's a good question. I haven't thought about, because I love everything in that book. But I guess number one favorite thing is just him and Julia's relationship. Yeah, I liked writing them.
What's next for you? Are you working on the second novel still?
Yeah, working on the second novel. Yeah, that's my plan, is to have it out early next year. Okay. Have it available. And I'm turning this first book into a screenplay right now.
Oh, cool.
So I'm putting it into format for screenplay. Like, I would love, a lot of feedback I do get is like, this reads like a movie. This reads like a film. And it's like, I agree. Like, I could totally see that. So I want to turn it to a screenplay and just see what actual movie people, producers think of the screenplay. And while writing my second book, of course, to keep the literary side going as well.
Another couple of questions, but one of them is just, what draws you to this genre, to the thriller?
Oh, yeah. I love a good villain. Like, I could think of, you know, Walter White, Dexter, Tony Soprano. It's like those villains that, like, you kind of root for them, but you know they're bad.
Yeah.
What they're doing is just so different. And their view of the world is so different. It's almost, it's intriguing to watch. It's fun to watch. So I've always wanted to create a character like that. That's why I called the series Bridgewater, because he's the driving force in this this series. And he's, to me, yeah, he's probably the most interesting character in the book. But there's some more interesting people that get created by the end of the first book.
Cool. Well, Marcus Gazaway, thank you so much for joining me today.
Yeah, thank you. It's been awesome. Yeah, this is a breeze. I can't believe it's been an hour already. That was great.
For listeners, you can learn more about Marcus at his website, marcusry.com, where you can also order a signed copy of Bridgewater. Catch Story Behind the Story the first Friday of every month from 5 to 6 p.m. on KSQD 90.7 FM. To share your thoughts on this or other shows, drop me a line at clara@ksqd.org. The Story Behind the Story is produced and edited for KSQD 90.7 FM by me, Clara Shirley Appel. Our mixing engineer is Linear Sammons. He also wrote our theme.